At Vertex, we know the pace of global commerce is increasing, which makes managing tax more complex. And your enterprise systems weren't built to handle that tax complexity. This is where we come in, with our platform that enables continuous compliance, giving you more transparency, improved accuracy, and better confidence in your tax data. To learn more about continuous compliance, visit vertexinc.com.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Welcome to this special edition of Democracy Sausage, indeed a second serve. And we're doing this today because the government has just released its long-awaited stimulus package in the wake of the worsening crisis afflicting the world, the COVID-19 crisis, and all of the economic implications that it has. Joining me to go through the details of this, and I guess to talk about whether it's going to work, whether it's going to be enough, are a couple of very bright people. One of them is Professor Peter Whiteford, a social policy expert at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And I have another Peter Martin AM, who was on Democracy Sausage just this week and is always welcome back in this tiny studio. Peter Martin AM, business and economics editor at The Conversation, former economics editor of The Age, and of course, well known on broadcast media around the place as well. Welcome
but
to you, Peter.
How are we going to do this, Mark? You'll say Peter and Peter.
It's going to be difficult, but we're just going. You have different voices, so we're just going to have to do it. I tell you what, I'll say Peter Martin when I'm talking to you. How about that?
Okay.
And I don't know how you're going to do it if you just jump in, but we'll just have to handle that.
Right.
So, look, Peter Martin, to kick things off, what's your sort of general response to this package? It does have, as we were discussing just a few days ago, we do have some of the same atmospherics that we had around the GFC, a crisis afflicting the world, Australia facing circumstances that will have local effects but which come from abroad as well, and a government needing to essentially throw out its agenda that it did have and move to a whole emergency setting. How do you see it?
It's been like the dance of veils. They've removed one veil at a time. I understand that as recently as a few days ago when we recorded the podcast earlier in the week, they were not going to do direct handouts to people. They've been mugged by reality and they're doing basically a Labor program. This is basically the Rudd Labor government's stimulus. Indeed, not much is different about it apart from the allocation of money to different amounts. This one has somewhat less going to households, a $750 payment, but it follows Treasury advice. There was a moment in the Prime Minister's press conference at lunchtime when Scott Morrison was asked why he thought people would spend $750 when they didn't spend $1,250, the extra bonus in tax returns that came as a result of the budget. And he said, experience has taught us that people spend cash payments. That experience was Labor's, and it's been made quite clear that people are not particularly willing to spend money when they get it later through the tax system. And the Treasury commissioned or used behavioural economics research on this in 2008 to say the best way, firstly, to get money out quickly is to put it in people's bank accounts, and secondly, that they're more likely to spend it. Scott Morrison has become a reluctant convert.
A reluctant convert.
You know, in a matter of days, things are different to what I understood they were a few days ago. And we can perhaps see this in the delaying of the announcement. So the announcement was going to be on Tuesday after the Cabinet meeting, then Wednesday, now Thursday.
Yes, it was interesting to look at the body language and also the words that were spoken by the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. They seem to be quite proud of this package and quite confident that it's going to make some sort of difference. They have left open the prospect of doing more.
They have to.
You know, he's been talking about it being scalable all the way through, to be fair. But this is bigger, much, much bigger. It is approaching 1% of GDP. So it's much bigger than was being envisaged, as you were just saying, by them not so very long ago. It is different, though, in a couple of ways from the way the approach that Labor took, and that is what the government is very keen to stress, isn't it, when you're looking at the politics.
They're not building school halls. Well, you couldn't, could you? That's already done.
That's what I was going to say, that they're not using that kind of, you know, Keynesian pump priming idea that that the school infrastructure program was. They are, in fact, placing a very heavy emphasis on business, on getting money to businesses to try and keep businesses that employ people, keeping those jobs open for those people. So we're seeing a lot of money channeled towards business in the form of the instant asset write-off, which goes to $150,000, and also this $25,000 injection to keep people employed.
Yes, and that's probably appropriate because history shows that when unemployment starts to rise, if it goes up, well, certainly if it goes up one percentage point, it just keeps going up. It's really not something that you want, and Labor managed to stop that then. You're right. It is different in one way. Labor's program had sort of three phases to it: immediate, medium term, and longer term. And the school hall program was so long term that some of them were being built, you know, well and truly after the economy had recovered. This is very focused on the immediate. There's, I suppose you can call the next year medium term, but it's really focused on the next few months.
It's really focused on the next quarter, the quarter
exactly.
We're actually about to enter into, because, of course, we know the story of that, Peter Whiteford. It is that this government is facing a situation where it could be the first to preside over a recession in, you know, close to three decades, 28 years or something is the record for growth in Australia.
And in the world.
Yeah, and they don't want to be the first government that has presided over this recession. We're pretty sure the quarter we're in is in negative growth. If the next one, the one that begins after March 31st, is also negative growth, then, you know, we have technically a recession. And it looks like the government is moving sort of hell on high water, really, to try and pump prime growth through that period. There's $11 billion of this $18 billion package or $17.6 billion package that actually goes out the door.
The next 3 months.
Yeah, before June 30. So they're pretty determined to try and get growth happening, aren't they?
Yeah, one of the interesting things I think about our ability to do that is actually reflects the nature of our social security system. And that is that we have a highly centralized social security system. So, you know, New Zealand and Britain and Ireland to a lesser extent are a bit like ours. But, you know, in America, a lot of the social welfare programs are effectively run by the states. Now, they're partly funded by the federal government, but yeah, that you have to coordinate a lot of different people. Whereas in Australia, we have one government agency that is able, you know, by the middle of April to send checks out to a quarter of the Australian population, basically a quarter of Australian households. So it's actually – so one of the things I think is interesting is that we have the capacity to act much more rapidly than most other countries on this particular side.
But you as could you call said, it robo-checks, Peter. It's the same infrastructure.
It's the same – yeah, it is the same infrastructure.
From the man who invented the term robo-debt, I believe, Peter Martin. Well,
but it's the same infrastructure.
Yeah. And in fact,
and it can work quickly.
And it can work quickly, which is a good thing. So, yeah, no, I think the numbers I've seen is that the checks will all be in people's bank accounts for the household side by the middle of April.
Yeah, you know, that's so right. They're going to start flowing from March 31st, I believe, and they will all be there. Yeah. Now, they are going to anyone effectively who receives some sort of welfare income from the government. So this includes people on Newstart. It includes people who are on NDIS payments, family tax benefit payments. It's a fairly wide group, but it is, I guess, to that extent, Peter Whiteford, it is targeted toward the middle and bottom?
Yeah, I mean, we have the most targeted social security system in the developed world, because we income test virtually everything in one way or another. So, we're talking on the whole about the poorest 25% of households and, 80% of all our social security spending goes to the bottom half of Australian households. So it's very targeted. And that, I think, is why the government hopes it will be effective in terms of, spending the money, because on the whole, there will be some exceptions. These are people who don't have a lot of spare cash. Some of the age pensioners are better off, obviously, because it'll go to part rate age pensioners. But particularly people on Newstart, on parenting payments, on carers payments and disability support pension. These are people who you stop getting Newstart if your other income's less than about $22,000 a year. So, it's very targeted to the bottom of the distribution. So you'd expect people to be spending this money.
And there's been a lot of commentary in the lead up to this about targeting those payments toward that end, and also about the idea of increasing Newstart, which, we can come to in a moment. But, the logic is that the less money you have, the greater proportion of that you spend, you don't invest and save and so forth, and that people get that money and it goes straight back into the economy.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, age pensioners are a bit different because, even though they will be on the whole in the bottom half of the overall income distribution, about 70% of people over the age of 65 receive an age or a service pension or something else. So it's a broader group than it is for working age people. And you can have reasonably considerable assets. So I expect amongst age pensioners it won't all be spent, but certainly there are lots of poor age pensioners who will, I would have thought, spend it all. I think the inclusion of Newstart and other working age payments is the really positive element of this. Although, as you said,
it's temporary. That's the thing, though.
Yeah, it's temporary. It's temporary. Yeah.
Temporary, targeted, scalable. I mean, these are the sort of terms. But I'm wondering whether we've missed an opportunity, or whether the government's missed an opportunity here to they say never waste a crisis. Well, there was an opportunity really here to do something about the parlous state of Newstart. Yet the government, going back to Peter Martin's point a minute ago about not wanting to, look like Labor and sort of very strongly drawing this contrast with Labor's plan, the government didn't want to do anything that created what they are terming a fiscal hangover. All of this, everything they're doing, even though there's a large amount of money being pushed out the door, all of it can be wound back when the economy and the budget are bouncing back too, theoretically. And that seems to be very strongly built into this. So they can sort of make that very clear distinction that we're not like Labor and we're not, condemning the country to another 10 years of structural deficits.
Yeah, the real,
if you buy it.
The $64,000 question, as we all know, is it going to work? And I personally think that the impact of coronavirus is so unclear at the moment that, I would certainly doubt that it's just going to be temporary, that the next quarter is going to resolve it all. I mean, one hopes, keep our fingers crossed that it does. But
news has been on the downside so far, hasn't it?
Well, the news from over countries is pretty spectacular, to say the least. Italy this morning announced it was closing everything except supermarkets and pharmacies, right? All its shopping things now.
Yeah, except for food stores. I noticed that Denmark is closing schools. I noticed that the US has just announced a travel ban for the entire European continent, save for Britain, of course, which is in the process of not being part of Europe, of course, and which is not on continental Europe. But that's a pretty dramatic thing. And it includes, Peter Martin, interestingly, it includes goods, not just people, but goods, apparently. So it's an extraordinary development and suggests – I mean, Trump says that the virus isn't going to have a chance. Those were his words.
Can I just add, because I was actually listening to the first 5 minutes of his talk and he did say goods, but I have read subsequently that goods are not included. There are three things in the first 5 minutes that apparently are incorrect. So
it's not like him to get things wrong, surely.
No, so the goods are not included.
Well, that's actually probably an okay rate for the president.
And
just
that,
three
well,
things in 5 minutes.
Well, the other thing is that the insurance companies are going to give not require co-payments for the test, but they are going to require co-payments for any treatment, which apparently he said that there wouldn't be co-payments for the treatment. And I think the group of people who are affected is, you know, sort of any American citizen overseas is also going to not be as affected. So, but yeah, he actually said these things, right?
Yeah, he did. And let's face it, it's all over the place, much like his presidency.
I think we can rely on what our Prime Minister said at lunchtime. I don't think he will change things in the next little while.
It does seem to be a somewhat more organised response. It's taken them a little while to get out. We'll come back in a moment. We'll just take a quick break. We'll come back in a moment and talk a bit more.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/ACAST. That's greenlight.com/ACAST.
More about this.
Australia's bushfire season was devastating and unprecedented. More than 20% of the country's forest burned, destroying buildings, taking lives, and decimating animal populations and biodiversity. But this season's fires haven't just changed the physical landscape, but also the political one. They've sparked a national conversation on fire management, the impact on vulnerable communities, and how the country needs to tackle climate change. Join the team from Policy Forum Pod at a very special live event where we look at what comes next. With a panel of experts, we'll examine the long-term impacts of the bushfires on Australia's economy, health, and biodiversity, and look forward to what the country could and should be doing in the wake of the crisis. Australia Ablaze, What Next? Takes place at the Australian National University on Tuesday, the 24th of March. Register for this free event at policyforum.net/events.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Sausage Second Serve. I'm Mark Kenny, of course. With me is Peter Whiteford, professor at the Crawford School of Public Policy, an expert in social policy, and Peter Martin, who is a business and economy editor at The Conversation and has held a range of other high-profile media roles. And, in fact, is a former Treasury official many years back.
Well, I should point out my colleague Peter Whiteford is a former OECD official, Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development, where he compared Australia's welfare systems to the rest of the world. And this is a point I want to bring in, which is that the Prime Minister was asked today about where health and the economy intersect, and that's keeping people away from work who are sick. Now, you wrote a piece for The Conversation this week, Peter, pointing out that casual workers don't get sick leave. The Attorney General, Christian Porter, said, well, that's fine, they're paid more to compensate for that, a comment which didn't go down terribly well among workers in restaurants and so on. But we do have something called sickness allowance, and I think it's insubstantial. And it takes a while to process, but the Prime Minister did announce that the waiting period for that would go, and also the waiting period for going on Newstart. Now, do those address your concerns, the concerns that you raised this week?
Unfortunately, one element of those waiting periods is unclear. So, because there are two waiting periods for most payments for people of working age, there's 1 week that everybody has. What's called the ordinary waiting period, which is partly about the time it takes to process applications, et cetera. But then there's what's called the liquid assets test waiting period, which has been around since the early 1990s. It was Labor government, Keating government, I think, that introduced it, which says that if you have more than $5,000 in readily available assets, you can, depending on how much it goes over it, you can wait up to 13 weeks before you get a payment. So partly it's about making sure people use their own resources before they call on the public resources. So it's not clear to me what the Prime Minister was saying about the liquid asset test waiting period. Indeed, they have legislation before the Parliament to increase that waiting period to 26 weeks. But
all of this much longer than the 14-day quarantine period.
So if the liquid asset test waiting period is still around, some people will, be getting, they will be looking for a job or still at their job because they're not going to get any sickness allowance or any new start. And that's the risk. The risk, because I think the interesting thing about this economic challenge is that there's an element of it that's completely different from, say, the 2008 global financial crisis and most other economic recessions, is that, while we obviously and the governments are obviously aiming to keep people employed and to keep businesses operating. In fact, one of the things we need to do as part of a pandemic is stop people going into work. Now, normally in recessions, you want to keep people at work, but in this one, or with this challenge, we want to stop people working.
It's a very interesting kind of difference, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's also, it could be much more broader than that. So say, for example, we start closing down childcare centres and preschools and schools as ways of, which is perfectly possible, right?
And it has direct material implications for parents then.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody has to stay at home and look after the children, and you may not want your elderly grandparents to look after young children who've been in a childcare centre, So it's sort of – So it's not just casual workers, but it's also the self-employed, and then there's whatever happens more broadly. And it's that combination of factors and, what's the prognosis for the virus, which I think it's really unclear what's going to happen in terms of, whether this is going to be effective or not. Yeah, as I said, we all hope it will be, but but it's really unclear about that. And, say for example, and it may even be that, people may have already used up their sick leave this year, even if they've got sick leave, because it's 10 days. You can get, you can use your personal leave to look after a sick relative. I'm not sure whether you can use your personal leave to look after a child who's, at home because they've closed down the childcare centre, who's not sick.
Well, that's an interesting point, because one of the things the Prime Minister's been saying, and he said it a number of times now in a number of ways, but he's been sort of saying companies will, they spend a lot of money, doing advertising and so forth, establishing their corporate personality in the marketplace. Their corporate image or personality will be defined through this crisis. Now, I can sort of, feel a little bit of a tang in that comment, because, this government's had this problem with, corporate do-gooders, corporations getting involved in social and political issues, and perhaps there's a little bit of payback going on there in some of those comments. But I guess what the PM is also saying is employers are going to need to be a bit more flexible than perhaps just the bare minimum of rules would say in respect of allowing their employees to work at home, allowing them to look after children, erring on the side of caution if they do have some sort of illness, because it has pretty direct implications for you.
I can actually see a quid pro quo here that not quite stated, but I'm giving you this investment allowance, I'm giving you this instant asset write-off, I'm supporting half of the salary or proportion of the salary of your apprentices.
Yes.
That's what I'm doing for you. Now, that will give you some ability to be flexible.
And that's all right for larger businesses, but for smaller businesses, it may be quite crippling not to have two or three key people there when your whole workforce is only eight people or whatever. So it is going to be there are going to be problems all over the place depending on how severe this gets, and it may get more severe as we move into the winter as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly, when you look at ABS figures, something like 30% of permanent employees, i.e. people who have access to paid leave, regularly work from home, and I imagine that could be boosted. But only 10% of casual workers regularly work from home. And that's because an awful lot of casual workers.
You can't serve in a restaurant.
You can't serve in a restaurant if you're from home, right? So some sort of people can, you know, if you're sort of a web designer or you're doing something digitally there's a range of jobs, probably the better paid casual work that, where you can work from home. But there's a whole group of people who can't work from home. And I think that it's not clear to me that what they've announced is really adequate for a lot of those people.
What would you do, Peter?
Well, I mean, in the piece we did in the conversation written with Bruce Bradbury from UNSW, we suggested that they should look at a much larger payment, something more like the minimum wage, because this is what we actually do with parental leave.
What do you mean a much larger sickness payment?
Yeah, much temporary,
Just to clarify, the sickness payment that the PM mentioned today, which is already there and which is being renamed to something else, but it actually just operates – they're going to waive the waiting period, so you don't have to wait for 6 weeks to get it. But it will still be means tested and it will be at the new start rate, which is, as we know, very, very low.
Its current rate is about equivalent to 40% of the minimum wage, right?
40% of the minimum wage.
Now, when you add in – when you take account of the assistance that we and other places give with rental costs, that's the lowest replacement rate in the OECD. There's nowhere else that goes so low. Now, that's for a replacement rate is what proportion of your previous earnings do you get while you're unemployed.
But the US doesn't have such a thing, right? So.
Well, they, for short-term unemployed, in these sort of circumstances, you could get unemployment insurance, which has got a higher replacement rate. Now, so if it goes on for a year or something like that, you'd be much better off in Australia. But in the first 6 months, you get a much higher replacement rate in the US.
But the problem in all of this is when it gets down to that sort of level, you're talking about something that's an active disincentive for people to take time off work,
exactly.
Even if they are sick. Yeah. So you're not really getting the benefit that you would need to get from a public policy, from an epidemiology point of view.
Yeah. I mean, there was the case of the person in Hobart the weekend before last who went into work at a hotel because he was he didn't want to miss his casual hours, right? Because there's many things involved. One of which is, I need the money now. The second of which is casuals are much easier to dismiss than most other people. And so if you refuse a shift, are you going to get another one? In terms of the remark from the Attorney General about, casuals able to save up their money, in fact, I think the consensus of recent Australian economists, people as diverse as, on one hand, Mark Wooden and Inga Lass at the Melbourne Institute, people who work in IR, Ian Campbell, Sarah Charlesworth at RMIT, is that the loading does not compensate adequately for the difference in wage rates. In fact, there was a review of casual rates by the Fair Work Commission in 2017 that explicitly says in its summary of its case that it doesn't adequately compensate, and that one of the problems is that people often go into work when they're sick because they're not really actually being fully compensated for.
And these are jobs that very often have strong public interface.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're talking about the people who serve our coffee, we buy food from, who cut our hair, all sorts of things. Right. So so what we recommended in the article and the conversation was that this be temporary, right? You wouldn't necessarily need to do this on a permanent basis, but because this is a really unusual situation we're in, is have something that basically paid you the minimum wage for the time you're away from – you have to be away from work, which is what we do with the paid parental leave. We actually pay even if you haven't been working full-time at the minimum wage, we pay people the full-time minimum wage. And one of the things that came out of the evaluation of paid parental leave is that this actually increased take-up of time out of work more amongst the self-employed than any other group.
It's actually the self-employed as well as the casuals, because doctors, they were very upset at the treatment the Victorian health minister meted out to a doctor, saying she was flabbergasted that the doctor had gone into work. And the doctors are pointing out that they are highly unlikely to ever take sick leave. I think it's 0.5% of days per year, whereas their staff in doctor's surgeries, secretaries and, you know, medical assistants and so on, take much more leave. They're actually being paid a wage, whereas doctors are small business people, GPs. They have overheads and a sense of duty, and they're highly likely
to get sick.
Yeah. They're probably, apart from novel viruses, they're probably fairly immune, but they're highly likely to go into work.
Yeah. Mm. It's interesting, actually, that this package doesn't, you know, like there are some very generous elements in this temporary funding package, including this $25,000 back to small and medium-sized businesses. But that does not, as I understand it, extend to the self-employed who are not employing someone else as well, because it's all about keeping people, keeping jobs open. So if you're a sole trader, I guess you miss out.
Yeah. Well, I think they're potentially covered, and that is if basically, you know, sort of they have to be getting no other work, right? So you could then go in under current rules and claim sickness allowance.
Yeah, no, sorry, I was talking about for the $25,000.
Oh, for the $25,000. Yeah. But the household bit, but yeah, you know, like the household thing is, you know, like if you spend a year on it, you get $15,000, right? So, you know, it's not anywhere in the same ballpark for, in a month you get, you know, $1,500 or something.
Yeah. Now, we're going to have to wrap up here because we're talking for a long time. It is a really fascinating subject, this. I want to ask you just before we go, Peter Martin, about just your assessment about what we can derive, what we can conclude from the scale of this package. What is Treasury telling the government about the potential hit in this June quarter that we're looking
at? It's telling us that the potential hit is ginormous. Now, GDP grows these days around 0.5% per quarter. The Treasury thinks this will have an effect of 1.5%. Their aim is to stop the economy going backwards. Now,
that's a whole percentage point higher than what Stephen Kennedy, the Treasury Secretary, was saying.
That's right.
A few days ago.
He was saying that about the March quarter,
and
it's the June quarter coming up. So they're expecting something very, very bad in the June quarter. Now, the other thing to say about the size of this is it's almost certainly not enough, and that's okay. Labor came back with a second stimulus package last time. The famous mantra from the Treasury Secretary, Ken Henry, was go early, go hard, go households. They've done something. They've done it fairly early. It's of a reasonable size. They can and will come back for more. So, I give them good marks. I'm incredibly happy that they've done something. And I'm also glad, I think we mentioned this in the podcast earlier this week, that a lot of the people who were around in the coalition when Tony Abbott took office have now gone. Your Joe Hockeys and
Andrew Robbs
and so on, who were so critical of what Labor did. And it's as if they've absorbed the truism that in a crisis we're all Keynesians, and in a crisis they are following standard advice, which works, has worked in the past, to get us out of it. And they're doing it fairly big, and they're doing it pretty soon. So I'm pretty happy.
Yes. All right. Well, I endorse those comments. I think it's pretty clear that they are following Treasury advice. It is pretty clear that that advice is fairly dire in terms of the implications for the economy. And as you said, Peter Whiteford, at the beginning, we just really don't have a proper handle. We can see this is bad in terms of its economic impact. We don't know how bad, and we don't know for how long. But at this stage, the government's certainly putting a strong, you know, policy instrument into play with this this funding injection, and we'll just see where it goes. Can I thank you both for joining us here on this Democracy Sausage Second Serve, Peter Whiteford from the Crawford School of Public Policy and Peter Martin from The Conversation, and thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye for now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.